The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
When I was growing up, my first experience of prayer was going to synagogue with my father for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. My family is not a very practicing family in terms of Jewish tradition, although now they are much, much more. But when I was growing up, I knew I was Jewish because my parents had a Jewish accent and we ate chicken soup quite regularly. You know, that was the extent of my feeling Jewish. But we did go Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to shul, to synagogue. And I can still imagine it, I can still see it in my mind, hanging out in the stairwell, playing with my friends, when I know that something heavy is happening inside that room because it's Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And my first impression of prayer was, I kind of thought, I mean, thinking back now, then, even though I would not have used this terminology, but it kind of sounded like an auction. You know, if you've ever heard an auction, because basically it sounded like, Amen. Hallelujah. Amen. And that was what I thought. So as a child, I thought, these people, they're really professionals. I'm like, these people, these grown-ups, they know how to say 200 words in like a minute, right? And I thought that was really where it was at. But then as I grew a little older, I realized it's impossible. How could a person say 200 words in a minute? So I realized that, no, that's not what they're doing, right? What they're actually doing is saying the first word of the page and the last word of the page, and they kind of just do this hum. Because, of course, God knows what's in this book because he's heard this thousands of years already. So they probably don't want to waste God's time. And they probably just figure, you know, just say the first word and the last word. But what I couldn't understand as a child is, why don't they simply read out the page? That would be interesting. In other words, everyone get together and say, page 46, page 47. But that's the mind of a child. But you know, very often the mind of the child is the most direct way of seeing things. Because they have no expectations, they have no prejudice, they just see it the way it is. And so as a child, it did seem very bizarre to me, this whole prayer thing. When I got older and began to study a little bit more about Judaism, I in fact found out that these people are able to say all those words in such a short amount of time. And I thought, well then, I guess that's the ideal one should aspire to. Now we're talking, I'm about 17 years old, and I'm beginning to seriously explore my Jewish identity. So I began going to shul. I mean, before 17, I went to shul sometimes also, and I would be sure to get there for the kiddush at the end of the shul. And I thought, well, you know, if you get there for Aleinu and Ein Kelokeinu, you know, then, you know, God will be appeased and leave you alone. So I always kind of thought that at least once in a while I should go to shul just to keep my God relationship intact. And, you know, and have those kiddushes with those little sweet nothings. You know those little, you know what a nothing is? They call them nothings. Is it only in Canada we eat nothings? But when I was 17, I decided that I wanted to explore Judaism in a much more serious way. So I began to go to study a little bit, and I started to pray on Shabbat. And there was a couple of friends doing that, which is really essential, because if you want to explore Judaism, you want to try and experiment living it, it's really hard to do it on your own. So I was very lucky that I had a couple of friends who were also interested in doing this. So started going to the synagogue, and what we started was something which we thought was quite unique. We called it the davening, the prayer. Davening is the word for prayer. The davening Olympics. See, it goes like this. See, what you're supposed to do when you do the 18 benedictions, is you're supposed to take 3 steps back. So my friend would be standing beside me, and I say, okay, and we take 3 steps back. 1, 2, 3. Right? And then we count. We go, 1, 2, 3. And we would basically shake, rattle, and roll, or they call it chuckle, rattle, and roll. And we thought the one who finishes first wins. Because that's what we again saw. Even though now we're 17, but we were on the impression that the faster you pray, the holier you must be. Because you see these other people praying at such incredible speeds, you realize that this must be something to aspire to. Then as I grew a little older, a little more mature, and asked more questions, I discovered that there is absolutely no ideal whatsoever to pray fast. Okay? And that if you're praying so fast that you can't even understand yourself, you can't even hear yourself, right? So then it may even be detrimental. Not only may it not be, you know, it's not just not okay, it may be in fact a problem. I am not judging people who daven fast. It could be that they are able to pray at a speed where they are still able to be intent and hearing and meaning what they say. Of course, that's certainly possible. However, if I don't understand what I'm saying, so then it's questionable exactly what am I doing and how important will this experience be. So then I started asking more questions about the meaning of prayer and asking for guidance, how to pray, what to do. And I went up to this guy and I said, I'm just getting into this, I'm very new at this, and could you give me some practical advice about prayer? So he says, yeah. Do you know what to do if the sun is setting, you're in the middle of downtown, you haven't yet prayed the afternoon prayer, which must be said before the sun sets, and you're in the middle of downtown. Do you know what to do? I said, no, I don't. I don't know what to do. He says, this is what you do. You get yourself a phone booth. Go into a phone booth. Open up the phone book. Right? Pick up the receiver. And you take three steps back, holding the receiver. You take three steps forward in the phone booth. And then you look at a very interesting number. Right? And then you call. Right? I was devastated. I mean, like, I'm opening my heart. I want to try and pray. And this is the first piece of advice this guy gives me. He then qualifies and says, but I want you to know something. A friend of mine was praying in a phone booth. And someone starts banging on the door. So, you know, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but in Israel, when there's a certain, you know what this means? Right? It means, rega. One second. So, of course, when you're in the middle of prayer, you're not supposed to interrupt it with speech. So he was on the phone praying to God, and he's in the phone booth, and the guy bangs on the door. So he goes like this, rega. The guy bangs on the door. So he goes like this. And he says, okay. So he walks away. And the fellow inside the phone booth finishes his prayer. He's walking down the street, and he sees the same fellow who is anxiously waiting to use the phone. So he walks up to him, he's at the corner, and he says, I'm sorry, buddy, I was on the line, and I was making a long-distance call. Right? So he says, oh, that's okay, I just wanted to tell you this phone booth hasn't worked for years. So he said, if you go into a phone booth, make sure that it's working. Okay, I was very disappointed. Because I started to feel that the art of prayer is somewhat lost amongst the Jewish people. And that, you know, somebody bought me my first prayer book when I was getting involved with Judaism. And what they did is they filled in the prayer book certain notations. Three steps back. Three steps forward. Bow. 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 Three steps back. Three steps forward. That was the notation I got with this little book that someone gave me. And they said, here, now you can pray. And it really is so much more difficult. To pick up a prayer book and try and feel something is very, very difficult. For that reason, much of the Jewish community is beginning to question the validity of the prayer book itself. Now, I worked for a Jewish organization, which was the biggest Jewish organization in the world, and I was doing programs. I got a million stories on that. But one particular story, I was called in by the head of the region that I was working for. I was hired by this organization to bring in more Jewish consciousness to the organization because there's a very high rate of assimilation and intermarriage among the participants of this organization, which is really quite frightening. So I was brought in to do some more Jewish programming. And, I didn't have as much freedom as I was hoping. And I was called in by the head of the region, and she said to me, we're going to be doing a convention. And we, part of the constitution of the organization is we have to have, if it's a convention that's happening on Saturday, we have to have one prayer service. That's like the rules of the organization, even though the organization is not Orthodox, it's not conservative. In fact, it considers itself eclectic. All right? So she told me that I had to do a prayer service. So I said, well, what would you like me to do? She said, I want you to do a creative prayer service. I said, well, what's a creative prayer service? She said, well, I could tell you some of the things we've done in the past. Last year, we had a puppet show. Right? I said, I'm sorry? Yeah, it was fantastic. We had a puppet show, and that was the prayer service. I said, a puppet show? I couldn't do a puppet show for a prayer service. She said, okay. She said, well, okay, the year before that, we had a slideshow. I'm saying, I'm in shock. And we're talking about a prayer service. What's a slideshow doing in a prayer? She said, oh, that was great. I said, no, I really couldn't do a slideshow, especially in Shabbat. She said, well, what else could I do? I mean, what have you done in the past, you know? She said, well, 3 years ago, we had readings. I said, oh, okay, readings. I said, like what? She said, oh, we had readings from the lyrics of Paul Simon, Bob Dylan. Olivia Newton-John went over very well. I said, Olivia Newton-John? She says, did you know she's Jewish? I said, no. She says, oh, yeah, that's a big hit for the kids. Big hit. They love that. They love that. I said, well, I really don't think I could do a prayer service of readings from Paul Simon, Bob Dylan, Olivia Newton-John. So she said, well, what are you going to do? I said, do you mind if I speak to the planning committee? She says, no, I don't mind. Go ahead. You can talk to them because this organization is really run by the participants. And whatever they decide is fine with me. I said, okay, fine. So I went looking into the closets and I found a prayer book, right? And they actually had this closet full of prayer books, full of dust. I mean, it hasn't been used in like decades. So I had this book to my side and I got in front of the planning committee, which was about 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds. And I said to them, listen, I've got this idea. I want to do creative prayer service. So they said, creative prayer service? Great, great. We always do that. What do you want to do? I said, well, I know you guys have done like some of the lyrics from Paul Simon, Olivia Newton-John, and I think that's really interesting. But I had something else that I thought would be really remarkable. I thought we would do lyrics this year from a very talented, on the charts for years, musician by name of David Ben-Jesse. They said, they look at each other, David Ben-Jesse, oh, he's been on the charts for years. I mean, this guy's on the top 10, certainly for years. They said, well, who is he? I said, oh, he plays this electric harp out in this place called Ein Gedi. He's written some of the most mind-boggling stuff. They said, well, wow, this sounds really interesting. Who is this guy? I said, oh, his stuff, well, where can we find this stuff? I said, well, it happens to be, and I pulled out this siddur. I, of course, blew off the dust, and I opened it up. And I said, well, he's in the Siddur. And they went, oh, you mean you want to use the Siddur? You know, and it became a four-letter word very quickly. So I said, well, yeah, why not? I mean, when was the last time you did a prayer service with the Siddur? They look at each other, gee, I don't, no. So what, wouldn't that be creative? I mean, imagine, we'll do something really weird. We'll actually use this book that hasn't been used in so many years. They said, oh, this is really interesting. They started getting excited. Yeah, we're going to do something really strange. I said, and you know what? Maybe we could pass out the books with all the dust and we could have like a dust blowing ceremony, you know, and really fill the room with some mystical cloud of dust. And well, it would be really interesting. Anyways, I got them very, very excited about doing, for them, which was now creative, a classic prayer service. Unfortunately, the head of the region nixed it. Told me I can't do it. I said, but you said they could vote. They don't know what they're talking about, and unfortunately, that's the way these organizations go. So the question really is, what is prayer? What is prayer? Does it work? Or how would it work if it does work? And these are very, very serious questions. Now, to really study prayer is a very critical course. Because my experience has been that most people's encounter with Judaism has in fact been with the synagogue. It's maybe the Passover Seder, right, and synagogue. Those are the two biggies of a Jewish encounter for many, many people. And unfortunately, many people are left with very bad feelings, negative feelings. questions about what happened in the synagogue. You know, it was boring, it was meaningless, it was... And so, to really explore prayer is critical. For me to really deal with my Jewish identity and how and if I want to move with it, I must somehow grapple with what is prayer. Especially since prayer really puts the whole experience head on in terms of a face-to-face encounter with the divine. Here I am standing there talking to air. I feel kind of stupid. I was once in a park in Los Angeles. I saw this woman sitting on this wall. She was kind of turned like this, and she was talking. I sat there watching her, and I felt so sorry. I mean, how did she get out of the insane asylum? She was really a sick person, and she was so involved in her dialogue, but yet she was all by herself, and she's just going like this and talking and talking. And I watched her, and I felt very sorry for her. As I was walking away, I walked past the wall, and at that point, I saw that there was, in fact, a man on the other side of the wall, and she was simply speaking to him. Imagine how your perspective can, in fact, change everything you perceive, right? And so imagine when you see a person at the wall, and they're intensely speaking, and you see air, there's no doubt that a person would feel that this is a little bizarre, and it could go from bizarre to insane. There's various shades of it. And therefore, we really need to have a handle, a real perspective on what is prayer. So the first thing I need to tell you is that in Judaism, there's no such thing as prayer. So we've just solved the problem. There's no such thing as prayer. Prayer is an English word. You will not find that word in the Bible, right? This has always been the problem in studying Judaism, which is Judaism has been translated into another language, and we understand that other language vis-a-vis our experiences within a non-Jewish world. Okay? And so therefore, you know, if I heard the word prayer and it clicked certain things in my mind of maybe some shows like the PTL Club, Praise the Lord Club, or whatever, you know, and I see people like this, Lord be, you know, that might turn some people on, that might turn some people off. In other words, I'm dealing with all words have to be understood vis-a-vis my experience. If I've never had an experience of love, I could never understand the word love. Correct? Right? So, and to the extent that I've experienced love, will determine the meaning of the word love. So too, with anything else. To the extent that I know the meaning of the word prayer, but within a non-Jewish world, to that extent is what the word prayer means, to that extent I begin to associate that meaning with the word lehit palel, which is what Jews do. Okay? I assume that Jews pray. But it's not true. Because there's no such thing as the word prayer. It's not a Hebrew word. All we have is Hebrew words. So we have a Hebrew word that has been translated into an English word, which then needs to be translated into my experiential understanding vis-a-vis the social upbringing and encounters that I've had in my life. And so I'm really very far removed from the original meaning of what Jews do three times a day. Okay? So now I want to understand what does prayer literally mean in Judaism, or what do we do? So get it out of our heads, Jews don't pray. But what do Jews do? There's a number of things. One thing they do is something called lehit palel. And that's what I want to understand. I want to know what that word means, right? Now if I look in a dictionary, it's going to translate it into prayer. Okay? But I want to know its original meaning. And you're going to be having a class on the mystical insights to the Hebrew language and how so much of its philosophy is in fact embedded, ingrained in the structure of the words and the correlation between words and other words. All right. So I really want to get into a genuine sense of, I want to feel this word. I want to feel this word and I want to come out with a new experience for this word. So that when I see it, I don't think prayer, but I think of what it is in its original. So let's think about this. First of all, you probably are familiar with the fact that Hebrew has different conjugations, right? Conjugations, all right? The way a verb is conjugated has a lot to do with how the verb will be understood. For instance, what is the word for getting dressed, right? Lavesh. Lavesh, okay? Now, if I want to dress my son, in the morning I dress my son up, what would I say? Ani malbish oto. Okay? I dress him. Okay? But if I want to dress myself, what would I say? Ani mitlabesh. So there's this notion called reflexive in the Hebrew language. Alright? Whereby I take a root, okay? In this case, the root is palel. And then, depending on how I conjugate this root, will determine what exactly am I doing. Am I doing something to somebody else? Am I doing something to myself? Is that okay? Everyone with me? Okay. So we have something very interesting about this verb. The verb is lehit palel, which already tells me something. What does it tell me? Ah, perfect. There's something I'm doing to myself. I don't know what I'm doing to myself, but already suggested in the way the verb is set up is that it's somehow a very self-oriented experience. This is very critical. Very, very critical. Because if I have the wrong perspective of what I'm trying to accomplish in the tefillah, the lehit palel experience, all that will determine my behavior. For instance, I've got a whole new consciousness over here. When I pray, what am I really asking myself? Okay? What am I really hoping to experience? Am I asking, did God hear my prayer? Or perhaps what I need to be asking myself is, first and foremost, did I hear my prayer? Because if I didn't hear my prayer, then why would I assume God would hear my prayer? Okay. In other words, if I am speaking like blah, 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 right, and I'm saddened to say that I've seen people in the midst of their prayer looking at their watch, taking out, you know, I mean all kinds of things. You know, people in the middle of the prayer hear their telephones. What do they call them? Their portable phones. Is that what they call them? Cellular phones, right? And all of a sudden, nowadays, you can be in a minyan and you hear these bells ringing, you know, it's like the new age that we're in, and the guy picks up his phone going, you know, and like, come on, you know, like, you're on the line, at least have call waiting, right? You don't have call waiting, I'm on the line, and I'm right, you know, if I'm really on the line, I wouldn't even hear my phone, right, if I'm really on the line. So, if I think that the meaning of prayer is to communicate to God something that God doesn't know, so then the whole experience becomes somewhat silly. I would say even more than somewhat silly, right? Because let's think about what that means. Dear God, you probably haven't noticed, my leg hurts, okay? Now, could you please fix my leg? Now, when you think of it, it sounds a little ridiculous. Number one, obviously, if we believe in a God, then generally believe in an omniscient God. That the divine is an all-embracing consciousness who knows everything. Alright. So therefore, the divine knows about my leg. But more than that, the divine is probably, and more than probably, is responsible for my leg hurting me. Right? In other words, it's kind of a little silly to say, well, you know, my leg is hurting me. In other words, there's a deep and serious problem with the whole notion of prayer. How can I ask God to heal me when if I'm sick, then most probably, and actually more than that, from a Jewish perspective, all is under the supervision of God. Okay? And so if all is under the supervision of God, how can I pray to God? I mean, you want me to be sick if I'm sick, right? And there must be a reason that I'm sick. So then why should I be praying that you should make me no longer sick? Do you follow the problem philosophically? The fact that we haven't asked the question is what makes prayer so meaningless for a lot of people. Because deep down inside themselves, they feel that, what exactly am I trying to accomplish here? You know I'm not well. You're probably the reason I'm not well. And most probably, from the Jewish perspective, there's a good reason that I'm not well, because I have to do tshuva, I have to fix myself, or I've got to learn something, or whatever. And so what's the point of praying? The Gemara says that tefillah is bakasha. That the essence of tefillah, the essence of prayer, is the request. There is a build-up to it. There's praise, which we're going to talk about also. But the essence is bakasha. Okay, it is a request. And the whole point is, what am I requesting? Why am I requesting? What's the point of request in the first place? All right. Now, if I start to think in these terms that I'm somehow communicating to God something that God doesn't know, So of course at that point I'm going to speed up my prayer. Right? Because I feel somehow intuitively that God knows, and therefore I can say it faster, and God has heard this before. He's heard it a million times before. I once heard a very cute story from Rabbi Shlomo Kalbach, Zichrono Levracha. He was a great rabbi and a musician. So he says over a story that when he was a kid, 10 years old, he had a twin brother. And so one day he walked into his room and said, I'm going to go now and pray to his brother Eli Chaim. So finally he went in there, and he was in there, and he said, he didn't come out for 3 hours. So Eli Chaim was in shock. I mean, what was he doing in there? 3 hours praying? I mean, what is he doing in there? Finally, 10-year-old comes out, and he says, what were you doing in there? So I was praying. So how long can you pray for? It was 3 hours you were in there. He said, I prayed 365 times, right? The 18 benedictions, right? So he said, what? Why? He said, this way I don't have to pray for the rest of the year, right? Now that's the way a child thinks, but remember, children are very, very on target. Because when you think of prayer in a silly way, like I gotta do this, and God has heard this all before, and so what's the point? So then of course, why I could just knock it off in one day, and I'm good for the whole year. Which is why people go just for Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. Because the whole idea, the whole context of the human-divine relationship and the meaning of prayer has become somewhat silly, you know? And so therefore, I do it out of guilt or whatever, out of identification, I don't know. But I do it. But I don't understand what I'm doing. And if I don't understand what I'm doing, how can I do it with a full heart? How can I really feel what I need to feel? So the first thing we need to know, without even knowing the root, is we need to know that the act is reflexive. And if you don't change in your prayer, nothing will change. Okay? When a person is in a prayerful experience, then something should be happening to them. And if something happens to them, then something will change. And we'll talk about how that works soon. All right? Therefore, according to Jewish law, when you pray, you must enunciate the words. It can't be just in your heart. You need to enunciate the words at an audible level. You need to hear your prayer. That's what Jewish law says. Okay? Now it also says that you need to hear it, but not necessarily the person beside you. In fact, more than that, necessarily, don't. The person beside you doesn't need to be disturbed by your prayer. Okay? And so you're saying it in an audible whisper. Okay? Also important, to sense the closeness of divinity rather than feeling like I'm sending this long distance telegram to some God way out in the outer heavenly orbits. You know, it's like a feeling of intense intimacy, and I say it audibly. I need to hear my prayer. This, by the way, is essential for the experience. Okay, and Hasidic thought talks about this, that my words act upon myself and arouse myself. The words arouse myself, the arousal arouses the words. It becomes a circuit that feeds itself, and one ascends in this experience. But now I want to talk about the experience. So what we've at least accomplished is, and I don't want you to mistake and say that, well, then Judaism believes that God hears tefillot. Well, God does, but this is all anthropomorphic, this is metaphorical. God hears, God talks, God sees, all that needs to be clarified. But yes, we do say God hears, and we do believe that. However, it's important to understand that unless I hear my prayer, unless I respond to my prayer, then don't expect my prayer to have much worth. All right? That's important. Once I understand that, I'll slow down. Once I understand, I'll try and understand what I'm saying. Now, just a kind of technical question, just for a second. Some people ask, well, should I pray then in English or in Hebrew? That's a very good question. Because based on what I just said, it seems obvious that I would want to pray then in whatever language that I understand. However, the downside of that is that a person develops a certain handicap. In other words, they never really succeed in praying in the original Hebrew. And so what? Well, first of all, the English translation is really inaccurate and very problematic, is when we explore the Siddur itself. I'll show you times where one word could change so much the feeling of what's really being said. In addition, we believe, and this is a Kabbalistic idea that perhaps Rabbi Schluss will talk to you about vis-a-vis the language, we believe that Hebrew is the language of our souls. And that our souls respond to Hebrew in a very deep way. All right. And therefore, I'm not getting where I got to get to if I do it in English. However, then to do the whole thing in Hebrew and not understand a word, that would also be silly. So one must compromise as they evolve, do part of it in Hebrew, part of it in English, with the intentions of aspiring towards doing it in Hebrew, if anybody's at all interested in getting to that point. But as a side right now. Right now, I want to tell you, though, what the word palel means. Okay? What does the word palel mean? What am I doing to myself? I am paleling myself. Right? Okay. So the word palel is connected to evaluating. Okay? And very often people build a whole notion of prayer based on that, which is interesting. However, personally, I haven't found it enough satisfactory. Okay? In other words, there's no question that there's a certain self-evaluation that is happening in the tefillah experience. Because really, this is the acid test. I'm standing before, feeling a sense of presence of divinity. You know? And that's really what it's all about in Judaism, is living with that sense of walking with the divine and the implications that has on my human behavior, my sensitivities. So therefore, you know, when I'm studying Torah, that could be a scholarly experience. But when you're praying, there's no way to get out of it. I'm encountering, or I'm attempting to counter with the divine. And in so doing, there's a tremendous, I've put myself into a situation which is like a barometer. Alright? It's really the acid test of where I'm truly at. Okay? Because everything else I can fake off. It's very hard to fake off prayer. So there's no question that in the Lehit Palel experience, there's a quality of self-evaluation that emerges out of it. But that doesn't capture the essence of what it's all about. I'm not going in there to evaluate myself. Although a self-evaluation does occur through the experience. But it's not the essence of the experience. So, to understand the word Palel, I once mentioned to you in the last 3 weeks, there's something called a concordance. And in this concordance, which is an interesting kind of dictionary, it has cross-referencing for every word in the Bible. Okay? In other words, if I want to find the word ata, which means you, right? So I open this concordance, it will tell me every single place that the word you is found. It's unbelievable, this book. And you have to understand, this book was written before they had computers. I mean, nowadays, fine. Plug in Einstein and press a button, I got all the U's. Fine. But in those days, it was unbelievable how there were people who, in fact, would do these kind of concordances. All right? So, if I want to really understand the original meaning of the word lihit palel, which has been loosely translated to prayer, I look at the word palel. And I look around. And I found a very nice verse. This is a verse in one of the most beautiful scenes in the Torah, in the Bible. Yaakov, one of our forefathers, the third of the forefathers, I know that's confusing, but the third of the forefathers, he is nearing his death. He had 12 sons, one of the sons was Yosef. You may be familiar with the fact that the other sons sold Yosef into slavery. Not a nice story, but nonetheless, it happened. And Yaakov, his father, mourned for years. Mourned for years, couldn't forget his son, because somehow inside him, without knowing it, subconsciously, he must have known his son wasn't dead, but he could never be consoled. Finally, he finds out that his son is in fact in Egypt, and now he's not only in Egypt, but he's functionally the king of Egypt. Unbelievable. And because of these remarkable events, he's going to support the entire family, and the whole family moves down to Egypt. And that really starts off the whole exile into Egypt, and the servitude in Egypt happening many years later. Yaakov's living in Egypt. Yosef has two sons. Okay? Ephraim and Menashe. Okay? Yosef is notified that Yaakov is about to die, or he's closing in on his last days. So Yosef comes to his father for a prayer or for a blessing. And we're going to talk about the power of blessings. But right now, he goes to his father for a blessing. And that's more than, you know, la briut or, you know, bless you when you sneeze. But it's like there's a real power to blessing. And he wants to be blessed by his father. And he brings his two sons, Ephraim and Menashe, to Yaakov, their grandfather, for a blessing. Yaakov says to Yosef, he says, Lo palalti. I never palaled that I would have seen your face. And here God has granted me to see the face of your children. Tell me, what does the word palel mean in that context? I never palaled, okay, that I would have seen your face. And God has granted me to see your children's face. What do you think the word palel means? Imagined. What else? Never thought. What else? Never dreamed. What else? Never believed. What else? No, wouldn't be asked. Because I would have asked, but I never would have believed it. I never would have anticipated. I never would have expected. All these words and more give me a taste of what palel means. Rashi, the commentary, explains palel means, right? I never filled my heart to think the thoughts. Fill my heart to think the thoughts. This is wonderful, wonderful definition of the word palel. Palel is to fill my heart to think those thoughts, those dreams of dreams, those visions of visions, those expectations, those anticipations. And yet, why would I never do such a thing? Why would I never fill my heart to think those thoughts? Why not? Why? I don't want to be disappointed. What does it mean, lehit palel? Lehit palel means to actively fill my heart to think those thoughts, to dream those dreams. Those ultimate dreams. And if I do that, that's the beginning of it happening. That's the beginning of it happening. To dream, to envision, to expect, to anticipate. That's a very essential understanding of what it means in the Lehit Palel. When I stand in tefillah, when I stand to Lehit Palel, what I'm going to do is intentionally incite my mind, my will, my imagination, my vision, my dreams. I want to see this. I want to see this. And if I believe I'm going to see it, then that's the beginning of it actually happening. Rav Kook, very famous rabbinic figure, explains that dreams are the beginning of reality. If you even think it, it's already the beginning of reality, because we believe that a thought is real. And therefore thoughts are seeds in the garden of time that will bear fruit if you keep thinking, if you keep willing, if you keep dreaming. You know why it's so hard to pray? I'm afraid to dream. You know people are afraid to dream? People are afraid to dream because they don't want to be disappointed. I don't want to be disappointed. Right? People are afraid to ask for the ultimate. You know why? I don't want to ask for the ultimate. I won't get the ultimate. Certainly if I don't ask for the ultimate, I won't get the ultimate. This is critical. Very critical. Lehit Palel is an exercise of imagination and will. Presenting it before the divine, the source of all, the omnipotent. You are the almighty. You can do anything. But in order for that to happen, I need to dream. I need to set the stage. That's what God is requiring of us. To set the vision. If I don't believe it's possible to be healed, it's hard to be healed. You know, it's hard to be healed. If I don't believe my situation can change, it's hard for my situation to change. Very important. There's a cute little story about two children. One is a pessimist, one is an optimist. So the optimist was praying for a bicycle.
please God, I want a bicycle by this Rosh Hashanah. Oh, please God, by this Rosh Hashanah, this New Year's, please, I want a bicycle, I want a bicycle. His pessimistic, cynical brother turns to him and says, oh, you idiot. You're stupid. God doesn't listen to prayers. God's not going to get you a bicycle. Right? Stop asking stupid things. He says, no, you'll see, Rosh Hashanah is coming, I'm going to get a bicycle, I'm praying to God, he's going to give me a bicycle. Sure enough, Rosh Hashanah comes, the New Year's comes, no bicycle. And the pessimist turns to the optimist, once the, you know, sun sets on Rosh Hashanah and the kid has no bicycle, he says, I told you, God doesn't listen to prayers, God doesn't answer prayers. So the optimist turned to him and said, you're wrong. God does listen to prayers. And God does answer prayers. And the answer was no. You see, that's the problem. People expect that when I pray, the answer is yes. The answer could be no. I'm afraid to pray. I'm afraid to think. I'm afraid to dream. I'm afraid to start thinking what could be, because maybe it won't. Do you know that that's the essence of the Jews? If the Jews wouldn't dream of what would be, they would not be. They say a famous story about Napoleon. Napoleon visited Eretz Israel. He visited Israel. And he was being given a tour by Esther Schlusser. Famous story that Esther tells over. I always wondered how she figured that out at the time. No, I'm just joking. But anyway, so he's getting a tour of Eretz Israel. And he's got a tour guide. He goes into Jerusalem. And he sees the Western Wall. The Wailing Wall. And he sees Jews at the Wailing Wall, moving back and forth, crying and praying. So he turns to this guy and says, what is this? He says, oh, this is called the Western Wall. They call it the Wailing Wall. Well, what are those people doing there? He says, these are Jews and they're praying. So what are they praying for? So, oh, they're praying for the reconstruction of their temple. He says, oh, really? When was it destroyed? I says, over 1,000 years ago. Napoleon then responds, what? And they're still praying? That people will survive, he says. Now, I don't know if this is a true story or not, but I've heard this story. And whether Napoleon said it or not, that's the power. That's the power. As long as you keep dreaming, as long as you keep envisioning it. It makes it happen. It's part of making it happen. To pray is to fill my heart, to think the thoughts, to dream the dreams, to envision the visions, to ask, to imagine. And how does it work? Does it work? Well, Judaism says it does work. And there's two qualities here that I want to present to you. It takes will and imagination. Will and imagination. You have to imagine that you're well. You have to imagine that you've got this money that you're asking. Whatever it is, you have to imagine it. Because our imagination is an essential quality in designing our reality, which we'll talk about in a deeper way later. But I want to mention to you there's a psychology called psychosynthesis, developed by an Italian Jew. And part of the exercises that psychosynthesis does is imagination exercises. Imagine the taste of water. Wow. Imagine the taste of water. Imagine the sounds of birds. Okay. So recorded in this psychology book is a fellow who's doing these imagination exercises. Part of the exercise was imagining bells ringing. All right? So he's doing this exercise. One day, in the middle of, actually not in the middle of the night, but close to the morning, but still dark, much earlier than he would rise, he hears these bells ringing. And he figures, oh my gosh, I've been imagining these bells so long, I'm starting to go a little nuts, and I can't even sleep at night. Right? So he turns over and he still hears these bells ringing. Right? He says, what is going on with my mind? And he turns over and he still hears these bells ringing. Finally, he says, this is not my mind. He looks out the window
and he sees the church down the street, and the bells are ringing in the church. And he's in shock, because he realizes that these bells have been ringing every single day at this very same hour the last 5 years. He never heard them. Interesting story. They use this story in psychosynthesis to demonstrate that our receptivity to reality has a lot to do with our imagination. Right? And when he started working on hearing bells, he became more receptive to, in fact, bells. Alright? So, in the prayer experience, imagination is very important. That's why it's so important, for instance, in the prayer it talks about we're praying for redemption. Well, if I don't know what redemption is, then it's really going to be a very weak prayer because I can't even imagine what you're talking about. You know? Or if I have very bizarre understanding of what redemption is, and I've got some image of some Messiah walking down this ladder of light that emerges out of nowhere, it's going to be hard for me to imagine this kind of thing. So imagination is one essential quality of the prayer. But the other quality of prayer is the power of will. Will. The fact that I want this participates in bringing it into the world. Have you ever experienced maybe traveling with a person who's very negative? You know? You're in a youth hostel in Jerusalem. You say, hey, let's go to Sfat. I don't want to go out. Let's sleep in. Oh, it's hot. I want to stay in an air-conditioned room. Come on, come on. Let's go, let's go, let's go. I don't want to go. It'll be stupid. It's kind of hot. I don't want to go. Oh, come on, come on. Let's go, let's go. Finally, you schlep your friend out of bed, and you get on the bus to the central bus station. You get to the central bus station. Sure enough, just as you're about to get on the bus closes the door on your foot. You lose your shoe. Takes off a spot, you gotta wait 5 hours for another bus. Your friend turns and says, I told you. See? I told you this was a dumb idea. I told you we shouldn't go in this spot. Now we've missed the bus. Now you've blown it all. Why did we have to get up in the first place? Say, okay, cool it, cool it. Let's keep up, you know, fine. We'll wait 5 hours. Okay, we wait 5 hours. Get on the bus. Get up the spot really late. We've discovered that all the youth hostels are closed. Your friend turned, I told you this is a dumb idea. I told you we shouldn't have done this. I told you. Oh, so fine. We'll have to go into a hotel. We'll play a little more. Fine. Get to the hotel. Reach into my back pocket. Sure enough, wallet's stolen. I told you. Didn't I tell you we shouldn't be doing this? Right? You start to wonder, maybe I should get rid of him. Maybe I shouldn't travel with this person. They are putting out such bad vibes. They're putting out such bad attitudes. Right? They want this trip to fail, and in fact, it does. Do you know that some say, of course, God forbid, it's not a rule, but some say that people even make themselves sick because they're so afraid that they'll become sick, they'd rather be sick than have to be nervous about becoming sick. We are really forgetting or denying the power of our will. We are denying the power of our will. But what really is the power of our will? According to Kabbalah, the power of our will. What is will? What is will, anyways? You know, science cannot figure out will. Doesn't know where will comes from. What is will? No scientist can explain to you why I'm able to do this with my finger. Someone listening to this tape is probably wondering what he's doing with his finger. But what? And I won't tell you. Okay. Right? I want to. No, I don't want to. I want to. I don't. It's remarkable. How come I can do this? How come I can do this? Where is the will coming from? Nobody knows. Scientifically, it is the mystery of mysteries. Where does the will come from? Well, I'll tell you what Kabbalah says and what Jewish mysticism says, right? The will is a spark of God's own will within you. And God's will is referred to as the Ratzon of Ratzon, the will of will. And it's important to understand that life force is will. Life force is will.
what I want is my choice. But that I want, that I have no choice. I have to want to be standing here, otherwise I can't be standing here. I have to want to be sitting here, otherwise I can't be sitting here. Will is the foundation of life. And its essence is divine. That's what Judaism teaches. Its essence is divine. And I am constantly being bombarded with will. And if I lose my will, I lose my life. Depression, what is depression? Depression is when a person doesn't want to do anything. Then you know you're depressed. There's a popular Israeli song that said, the lyrics are, Lo bali lelechet v'lo bali l'sha'er. I don't feel like going, and I don't feel like staying. That's depressed. You're really depressed, you know. And you know what it feels like to be depressed, even though I'm sure nobody here's ever been depressed. But, you know, I can tell you that you feel like doing nothing. Even to go to sleep takes tremendous energy. You know, don't even want to go to bed. Depression in Judaism is one of the worst things I should do to myself or allow to happen to myself. I'm cutting myself off from the will of life. And the more will for life I have, the more life energy I have. So will is essential. And so much of Judaism, as we will be exploring even more so in the philosophy of mysticism course, is directed towards the cultivation of will. Because it is the foundation of life, it is the essence of life, and it is the link between the human and the divine. Important sentence. The link between the human and the divine. My particular will is a spark of the universal will. The will of the all, which we call the will of God. Let me read to you. This is a passage from Rabbi Cook, who was a great rabbinic figure. He was the chief rabbi of Israel from in the early 1900s. And this is what he says in one of his mystical books. He's got many different kinds of books. This is one that directly related more to the Kabbalistic teachings. Our intellect and will, like everything else in existence, is a spark of the all. And from the source of all does it flow. Our intellect and our will is a spark that flows from the all. The will of the all, which is what we call the divine, which we'll be developing more philosophy and mysticism course. The marvel of a human being's will, in all its glorious freedom, can only be understood as but one spark from the great flame of the larger will of all of existence, referring to God. The larger will. What is the will that's activating life? It's remarkable. Have you ever watched an ant? Watch it for 5 minutes and ask yourself, where's its battery? I mean, come on. How does this work? You know, it's remarkable. What is telling this thing to go, to move, to be alive? This is an encounter with the divine. This is an encounter of the essence, that will that activates and animates and propels life. The unique thing about a human being is that we have free will. That somehow the spark of divine will has been allowed freedom. Right? And what is the freedom of this spark of divine will, which is my will? I am free either to plug it back into its source or to divorce it from its source. And that's what prayer is all about. Prayer is to cultivate, articulate, right? Will, and to plug it into the source of all will. Let me read you something from a great Kabbalist by the name of Gicatelia, who is Italian, Jewish, but Italian. And this is what he writes. And those wise men of the ages who feared a change of will, if they had known the source called will, they would not have feared such a change. He's talking about the whole idea of, can God change his will? Right? So therefore, how can I pray? Do I think God will change his mind? Does God change? God is beyond time. What's the meaning of change if you're not within the context of time? So he says, those wise men who feared the idea of the change of will, they didn't know the source called will. For he who knows the nature of will knows it is unchanging. One found worthy, whose prayers reach that source, can attain anything he desires. You hear this? One who is worthy, right? Whose prayers reach the source. If my will, that spark, can reach the source from whence it's actually flowing, the mystery of this whole thing, which we have to talk about in philosophy and mysticism class, is how it's possible that this spark, this tributary of universal will, which is in me and you, and each one has their particular will, and yet somehow a tributary of this great flow of universal will, how could it be somehow cut off? That's a mystery that we have to talk about. But that reconnecting, plugging into that great exchange, whose prayers reach that source can attain anything he desires. For whoever finds me, God says, finds life and obtains favor of the Lord. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 35. Powerful. That is, he discovers and draws his desire from the source of will, from the Ein Sof. In other words, when I'm praying, I am an active participant in making this prayer happen. Right? I'm saying, I want health. And I know you are the omnipotent one. And I know that you are the source of everything. Right? And by connecting and acknowledging the divine as the source of all healing, as the source of all redemption, of the source of whatever as the ever, my wanting that, in my addressing the source of all that, and connecting to the source of all that, actually channels that into the world. Therefore, the word for will in Hebrew is ratzon, and there's a game that Kabbalists like to play called Scrabble, and with this we also have another word, sinor. The word ratzon, reish, tzadi, vav, nun, right, if you scrabble the words, the letters, you also spell another word, which is tzinor. A tzinor is a pipe. A tzinor is a channel. And therefore, prayer is a form of channeling. By articulating my will and connecting my will to the source, by addressing my source. Very powerful experience. Very powerful experience. It's a different kind of prayer we're talking about. We're not talking about communicating to God. We're talking about connecting to the source. By developing my will, which is a spark of that divine, that mysterious power of life, and connecting that power of life to the source from whence it really flows. Let me read you another piece. Also from Rav Kook. That ideal has never been absent from the Jewish people. What ideal? The constant ascent of the Shekhinah. The constant ascent of the imminent divine, which is called the Shekhinah. To whom we turn each day in our worship. The ascent of human will until it attains the place meant for it in the will of being and the will of all being. The light of will and absolute divine appearance revealed to him. What are we talking about? The real service, the work. Do you know that prayer is called work in Judaism? It's called avodah shebalev. Well, what kind of work is it? Prayer is work. People think it's worship. Worship sounds easy. And maybe it sounds hard because people don't like worshiping something. Fine. But the essence of the word is avodah. And avodah is work. To pray takes a tremendous amount of work. You got to learn how to do this. How do I articulate my will? How do I really imagine and see and understand what I'm saying? And then mechaven, which is to intend, to attune it to the universal will. If I do that, I participate in making that happen. Because when the spark connects to the source, then it becomes God's will. Do you hear this? If I can take my will and connect it up to the source of all will, then my will becomes God's will. It's a very powerful experience. So much so that the righteous, which is referred to as the tzaddikim, the Talmud says that Masha tzaddikim gozrim Hashem makayem. That which the tzaddik decrees, God fulfills. How can the tzaddik decree? Because the tzaddik, the righteous, holy person, is so connected to the divine. Their spark has been so connected to the universal will that what they say is essentially a divine will. Right? It's very, very powerful. Very powerful. The real labor is the revival of will and strengthening of the divine soul in mankind and in the world through good deeds and through true thoughts. Here Rav Kook is telling us a very important point. This all seems very, very nice. You know, in fact, there's a book called Wishcraft. Right? It's a New Age book, Wishcraft. And it talks about this idea, what you wish, what you will, you can will it, you can, you know, treasure hunting, imagine it. But according to Judaism, how does one cultivate will? Through good deeds and through true thoughts. It's not because I want it. No, it's a whole science. It's a whole art. How do I cultivate will? And if you can't cultivate will, you are losing the very essence of life, the very power of life. So this is a very new idea here. That according to Judaism, prayer is an exercise of will. Every day, I say, this is what I want to see in the world. You are the source of the world. You are the creator of the world. You are the mastermind of the world. This is what I want to see. If I don't want to see it, or if I say it but I don't really mean it, so that's what's going to happen. That's what I get. Yeah? What you see is what you get. And that's really what happens. If you can't see it and will it, then it just doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen as powerfully. So this is a new way of seeing prayer, which is the oldest way of seeing prayer, for those who really understood Judaism. It's not as if this is what I tell my kid. You know what I mean? In other words, as a child growing up, so there's a certain understanding of what tefillah means for a child. But as I mature and understand, I have to have new understandings of God, mankind, the dynamics between the divine and the human realm, then I need much more mature definitions of what the experience is. And when I have that more mature perspective, everything's different. Right? I personally love to pray. Right? I know a lot of people don't love to pray. I love to pray. It's not like I'm always praying on the highest level, unfortunately. But if you really understand and you get in touch with it, and you hear yourself speaking, you hear your will, the more you hear your will, the more you want it, the more you ask yourself whether you really want it, and that becomes a self-evaluating experience. What do you want? And prayer is an expression of will, an exercise of will. And everybody knows that if I don't exercise something, I lose it. That's the way it goes. So where do we exercise will? When's the last time I exercised will? People are so weak-willed these days. It's unfortunate. It takes away the power line of my life. What is the Siddur? What is really in this book, the Siddur? It's a brilliant exercise for articulating my will, presenting it before the source of all will, and making that connection and bonding with my source, bonding with my creator. And therefore, as much as I like Olivia Newton-John, she just doesn't cut what I was really trying to do. Right? That's what the rabbis have put into this prayer book. The prayer book is an absolute incredible ladder. I start off with praising God, because I have to understand before whom I stand. If I don't know before whom I stand, right? You know who I stand before? The source of all source. I can ask anything. I can ask anything. Because everything is possible when you really believe in God. Right? And that's the beginning of prayer. I gotta know, lifnei mi ani omed, before whom I stand. The whole prayer book, which is what we'll begin to understand, is a brilliantly structured journey, which really sets up the essential
perspectives, attitudes, feelings, so that I get to the climax. And I'm at the 18th benediction, where people stand in silence, not silence, but they stand with their legs together, and the whole congregation is quiet, and I speak in a whisper. And I make these requests, which is the 18 benedictions. The whole thing develops, right? It's based on Kabbalah, which I can show you how the structure of the Siddur correlates to the worlds that we believe in, the different dimensions, the spiritual dimensions. And we will talk about how one goes through the prayer service and literally walks through, ascends dimensions of consciousness to the point where they're really at the essence of will, standing at the threshold of the distinction between human and divine. It's really remarkable. The whole book is amazing. Why is it important to study prayer? You really get to know Judaism when you study prayer. You really get to know what Jews are really all about, what our history is really all about when you study prayer. Why? Because if you really want to get to know somebody, find out what they want. Find out what they really want. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people don't even know what they want, right? Well, a lot of people say they want this, but they don't really want that. They think they want that. They want to believe they want that. Find out what their dreams are. I was dating a woman. I want to know who is she. So I asked her to dream a little bit, right? So I say, tell me, what do you imagine is the most special day in the life of your home, your family life? What do you imagine? What comes to your mind? So she says, oh. Yeah. She says the thing. She says, oh, you know what? This is what I envision. I envision children coming home, doing mitzvot, doing commandments. Every time the child does a commandment, we put a star on a mitzvah chart, a commandment chart. A nice, colored star on the refrigerator door. So I said, that's nice. Okay. I said, what else? She said, that's it. That captures what I just see about my home and my family life. That mitzvah chart with that star and that little kid coming home and getting that star. So she obviously felt that I was slightly disappointed because I made a funny face. No. I said, really? I said, okay. So she said, well, what do you envision? What comes to your mind when you think about the day in the life of your family and your marriage? So I said, you know what? The image that comes to me always is light. I just imagine a home full of light. She then said, that could cost a tremendous amount of electrical bills. I said, you're right. Find out what a person is really dreaming about. You'll know where they're really at. The will, according to Kabbalah, is the root of our beings. It's connected to what's called the Sefirah, the attribute called Keter, the crown. The will is the crown of your existence. And if you're wearing a crown, you're a king. If you're not wearing a crown, you're just another animal in this universe. But the will is our crown. And depending on what we want and how we cultivate that. And I want you to know that is one of the most essential themes of Judaism. One that is so unknown to so many Jews. That Judaism is so much based on cultivating will. Empowering us with our will. Recognizing the divinity that's within us and that has been invested in us and that has been entrusted to us. That with this will, I can create the world. I can destroy the world with this will. What do you want? So, it's an important exercise. And you can do it if you want to. But take some time and write a list. What do you want? Because I tell you, unless you know what you want, you're not going to get it. You're just not going to get what you want. And then, after you write this list of what do you want? You're living, God willing, who knows how long you got. God, what do you want? Right? Write a list of what you want. Now, the next step is prioritize your list. Well, what would you want first? what are symptomatic of more essential wants? What's the root of? Is there one of these wants that's really the root of this? In other words, I want money. Is it money I want? Or maybe it's security that I want. And money is only maybe a particular way of seeing security. Maybe it wouldn't be money. Right? So I gotta look at the certain things I write in my list and say, wait, is that really what I want? You know? For example, I want to be an actress. Wait a second. Is that what I want? Or do I want to influence people? Or do I want to feel good about myself, which I thought I'd get by having people looking at me? Well, then maybe I don't want to be an actress. See, this is why a lot of people are frustrated. Because they really didn't get what they want. Because they identified a particular thing which is only a possible expression of what that want would be. But it's really not enough. So people want security. So they think it's going to be a car, they think it's going to be a house, they think it's going to be a cat. They realize that it's only a real loving relationship that's going to give them security. Right? So I made a mistake. I didn't really get what I wanted. This is not easy. After you prioritize your list of your wants, write a list of the major events of what you've done in the last week. And see if what you did this week has much to do with what you said you want out of life. Because if it doesn't, then chances are very good you're probably depressed. Right? And if you're not depressed, then you're sleeping. Right? Because you should be depressed. Because if your actual life has little to do with your dream life, then you have to choose which life you want. Okay? And where you're really walking. You know what the sages did? They wrote Judaism's dream list. When you really explore the 18 benedictions, you find out what do we want? What do we really want? What do we want first? What do we want second? What do we want third? And that has been the power of the Jewish people. The Jews generally knew what they wanted. And when they know what they want, they get it. But when they don't know what they want, they don't get it. They don't get it. And that's why I love prayer. Because prayer all of a sudden gave me opportunity to really think about what I want. And when I explored the prayer book, I realized that these sages were brilliant. That this is what a normal, healthy person would want. And this is what should be in the foremost of my mind. What do I want? You know, I had a student. I asked people, dream, tell me what your dreams are. You know, so I asked this one guy, what's your dream? He said, you know what? In fact, Rabbi, I have an occurring dream. A real dream. Oh, good. So tell me what it is. You have to put this in the context. The guy's a musician. Fine. So now this is his dream. He says, it comes to me a lot at night. I'm walking in a forest. It's dark. I'm not sure where I'm going, but I'm being drawn somewhere. I get to a clearing. In the clearing, I see a mansion, a ranch, something like that. I come closer to the ranch. As I'm approaching the fence, out walks Michael Jackson. And he invites me in for breakfast. So I don't know, I get this dream a lot. I said, ooh. I didn't want to let him know I'm sad. I mean, I'm really sad. So I didn't say anything. I just said, you have the sense as a guy in his mid-20s, or 50, you know, maybe. It was, I don't know. And I said, well, do you have another dream? I was hoping there must be another way. He said, oh, yes, I do. So good. Now I'm walking through this forest, and I'm being compelled. I get to a place. Now it looks kind of like an English kind of castle-looking. I come to the gate. Out walks Paul McCartney. And he invites me in for lunch. I didn't want to know where he goes for supper. You know, that's the tragedy of the world. We have forgotten dreams. We're dreaming about things that are so unimportant. I mean, it might be nice to have lunch with Michael and Paul. You know, that'd be nice. Right? I got to know what I'm dreaming for. I've got to be able to dream. You know, the Talmud says that if a person doesn't have a dream, it's a bad sign. If you haven't had a dream for a couple of days, I don't remember how many days,
It's a bad sign. You're not allowed. You're not alive. To be alive is to dream. I think it was Ben Gurion that said, to be in Israel, it's unrealistic. Dreams are reality in Israel. Right? If you don't dream, you're not real in Israel. That's what it's about. And so the tefillah, when you open up the siddur, which is what we're going to be doing, I really want to get in touch with. So what could I be dreaming for? What could I be hoping for? What could I be anticipating? Lehit palel is to fill my heart, to think the thoughts, to dream the dreams.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.